This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Dragon Teeth, a novel by Michael Crichton. Performed by Scott Brick. Introduction. As he appears in an early photograph, William Johnson is a handsome young man with a crooked smile and a naive grin. A study in slouching indifference, he lounges against a Gothic building. He is a tall fellow, but his height appears irrelevant to his presentation of himself. The photograph is dated New Haven, 1875, and was apparently taken after he had left home to begin studies as an undergraduate at Yale College. A later photograph, marked Cheyenne, Wyoming, 1876, shows Johnson quite differently. His mouth is framed by a full mustache. His body is harder and enlarged by use. His jaw is set. He stands confidently with shoulders squared and feet wide, and ankle deep in mud. Clearly visible is a peculiar scar on his upper lip, which in later years he claimed was the result of an Indian attack. The following story tells what happened between the two pictures. For the journals and notebooks of William Johnson, I am indebted to the estate of W.J.T. Johnson, and particularly to Johnson's great-niece, Emily Silliman, who permitted me to quote extensively from the unpublished material. Much of the factual contents of Johnson's accounts found their way into print in 1890, during the fierce battles for priority between Cope and Marsh, which finally involved the U.S. government. But the text itself, or even excerpts, was never published. Until now. Part 1. The Field Trip West. Young Johnson joins the field trip west. William Jason Tertullius Johnson, the elder son of Philadelphia shipbuilder Silas Johnson, entered Yale College in the fall of 1875. According to his headmaster at Exeter, Johnson was gifted, attractive, athletic, and able. But the headmaster added that Johnson was headstrong, indolent, and badly spoilt, with a notable indifference to any motive save his own pleasures. Unless he finds a purpose to his life, he risks unseemly decline into indolence and vice. Those words could have served as the description of 1,000 young men in late 19th century America. Young men with intimidating, dynamic fathers, large quantities of money, and no particular way to pass the time. William Johnson fulfilled his headmaster's prediction during his first year at Yale. He was placed on probation in November for gambling, and again in February after an incident involving heavy drinking and the smashing of a New Haven merchant's window. Silas Johnson paid the bill. Despite such reckless behavior, Johnson remained courtly and even shy with women of his own age, for he had yet to have any luck with them. For their part, they found reason to seek his attention, their formal upbringings notwithstanding. In all other respects, however, he remained unrepentant. Early that spring, on a sunny afternoon, Johnson wrecked his roommate's yacht, running it aground on Long Island Sound. The boat sank within minutes. Johnson was rescued by a passing trawler. Asked what happened, he admitted to the incredulous fisherman that he did not know how to sail, because it would be so utterly tedious to learn. And anyway, it looks simple enough. Confronted by his roommate, Johnson admitted he had not asked permission to use the yacht because it was such a bother to find you. Faced with the bill for the lost yacht, Johnson's father complained to his friends that the cost of educating a young gentleman at Yale these days is ruinously expensive. His father was the serious son of a Scottish immigrant and took some pains to conceal the excesses of his offspring. In his letters, he repeatedly urged William to find a purpose in life. But William seemed content with his spoiled frivolity, and when he announced his intention to spend the coming summer in Europe, "The prospect," said his father, "fills me with direst fiscal dread." Thus his family was surprised when William Johnson abruptly decided to go west during the summer of 1876. Johnson never publicly explained why he had changed his mind. But those close to him at Yale knew the reason. He had decided to go west because of a bet. In his own words, from the journal he scrupulously kept. Every young man probably has an arch rival at some point in his life, and in my first year at Yale, I had mine. Harold Hannibal Marlin was my own age, 18. He was handsome, athletic, well-spoken, soaking rich, and he was from New York, which he considered superior to Philadelphia in every respect. I found him insufferable. The sentiment was returned in kind. Marlin and I competed in every arena, in the classroom, on the playing field, in the undergraduate pranks of the night. Nothing would exist but that we would compete over it. We argued incessantly, always taking the opposing view from the other. One night at dinner, he said that the future of America lay in the developing West. I said it didn't, that the future of our great nation could hardly rest on a vast desert populated by savage aboriginal tribes. He replied I didn't know what I was talking about, because I hadn't been there. This was a sore point. Marlin had actually been to the West, at least as far as Kansas City, where his brother lived, and he never failed to express his superiority in this matter of travel. I had never succeeded in neutralizing it. Going west is no shakes. Any fool can go, I said. But all fools haven't gone. At least you haven't. I've never had the least desire to go, I said. I'll tell you what I think, Hannibal Marlin replied, checking to see that the others were listening. I think you're afraid. That's absurd. Oh, yes. A nice trip to Europe's more your way of things. Europe? Europe is for old people and dusty scholars. Mark my word, you'll tour Europe this summer, perhaps with a parasol. And if I do go, that doesn't mean, aha, you see? Marlin turned to address the assembled table. Afraid? Afraid. He smiled in a knowing, patronizing way that made me hate him, and left me no choice. As a matter of fact, I said coolly, I am already determined on a trip in the West this summer. That caught him by surprise. The smug smile froze on his face. Oh? Yes, I said. I am going with Professor Marsh. He takes a group of students with him each summer. There had been an advertisement in the paper the previous week. I vaguely remembered it. What? Fat old Marsh? The bone professor? That's right. You're going with Marsh? Accommodations for his group are Spartan, and they say he works the boys unmercifully. It doesn't seem your line of things at all. His eyes narrowed. When do you leave? He hasn't told us the date yet. Marlin smiled. You've never laid eyes on Professor Marsh, and you'll never go with him. I will. You won't. I tell you, it's already decided. Marlin sighed in his patronizing way. I have $1,000 that says you will not go. Marlin had been losing the attention of the table, but he got it back with that one. $1,000 was a great deal of money in 1876, even from one rich boy to another. $1,000 says you won't go west with Marsh this summer, Marlin repeated. You, sir, have made a wager, I replied, and in that moment I realized that, through no fault of my own, I would now spend the entire summer in some ghastly hot desert in the company of a known lunatic, digging up old bones. Marsh. Professor Marsh kept offices in the Peabody Museum on the Yale campus. A heavy green door with large white lettering read, Prof. O. C. Marsh, Visitors by written appointment only. Johnson knocked. There was no reply, so he knocked again. Go away! Johnson knocked a third time. A small panel opened in the center of the door, and an eye squinted out. What is it?
I want to see Professor Marsh.
But does he want to see you? Demanded the eye.
I doubt it.
I am replying to his notice. Johnson held up the newspaper advertisement from the week before. Sorry, too late. Positions all filled. The door panel snapped shut. Johnson was not accustomed to being denied anything, particularly a silly trip he did not want in the first place. Angrily, he kicked the door. He stared at the buggy traffic on Whitney Avenue. But with his pride, and $1,000 hanging in the balance, he got control of himself and knocked politely once more. I'm sorry, Professor Marsh, but I really must go west with you.
Young man, the only place you must go is away. Go away.
Please, Professor Marsh, please let me join your expedition. The thought of his humiliation before Marlin was awful to Johnson. His voice choked. His eyes watered.
Please hear me out, sir. I'll do whatever you say. I'll even provide my own equipment.
The panel snapped open again. Young man, everyone provides their own equipment, and everyone does whatever I say, except you. You are presenting an unmanly spectacle. The eye peered out. Now go away.
Please, sir, you have to take me.
If you wanted to come, you should have answered the advertisement last week. Everyone else did. We had 30 candidates to choose from last week. Now we have selected everyone except... You're not, by any chance, a photographer. Johnson saw his chance and leapt at it.
A photographer? Yes, sir, I am. I am indeed.
Well, you should have said so at once. Come in. The door swung open wide, and Johnson had his first full look at the heavy, powerful, solemn figure of Othniel C. Marsh, Yale's first professor of paleontology. Of medium height, he appeared to enjoy a fleshy, robust health. Marsh led him back into the interior of the museum. The air was chalky, and shafts of sunlight pierced it like a cathedral. In a vast, cavernous space, Johnson saw men in white lab coats bent over great slabs of rock, chipping bones free with small chisels. They worked carefully, he saw, and used small brushes to clean their work. In the far corner, a gigantic skeleton was being assembled, the framework of bones rising to the ceiling. Giganthopus marchiensis. My crowning achievement, Marsh said, nodding toward the looming beast of bones. To date, that is. Discovered her in 1974, in the Wyoming Territory. I always think of her as her. What is your name?
William Johnson, sir.
What does your father do?
My father is in shipping, sir.
Chalky dust hung in the air. Johnson coughed. Marsh looked suspicious. Are you unwell, Johnson?
No, sir. Perfectly well.
I cannot abide sickness around me.
My health is excellent, sir.
Marsh appeared unconvinced. How old are you, Johnson?
18, sir.
And how long have you been a photographer?
A photographer?
From my youth, sir. My father took pictures, and I learned from him, sir. You have your own equipment?
Yes.
No, sir. But I can obtain it.
From my father, sir.
You are nervous, Johnson. Why is that?
I'm just eager to go with you, sir.
Are you? Marsh stared at him, as if Johnson were a curious anatomical specimen himself. Uneasy under that stare, Johnson attempted a compliment.
I've heard so many exciting things about you, sir.
Indeed. What have you heard? Johnson hesitated. In truth, he had heard only that Marsh was an obsessive, driven man who owed his college position to his monomaniacal interest in fossil bones, and to his uncle, the famous philanthropist George Peabody, who had provided the funding for the Peabody Museum, for Marsh's professorship, and for Marsh's annual field trips to the West. Only that students have found it a privilege and an adventure to accompany you, sir. Marsh was silent for a moment. Finally, he said, I dislike compliments and idle flattery. I don't like to be called sir. You may refer to me as professor. As for privilege and adventure, I offer damned hard work and plenty of it. But I'll say this. All my students have come back alive and well. Now then, why do you want to go so much?
Personal reasons, sir, professor.
All reasons are personal reasons, Johnson. I'm asking yours.
Well, professor, I am interested in the study of fossils.
You were interested? You say you were interested. Young man, these fossils, his hand swept wide, gesturing to the room, these fossils do not invite interest. They invite passionate commitment. They invite religious fervor and scientific speculation. They invite heated discourse and argument, but they do not thrive on mere interest.
No, no. I am sorry.
No, no, indeed.
Johnson feared he had lost his opportunity with his chance remark, but in another swift change, Marsh smiled and said, Never mind. I need a photographer, and you are welcome to come.
He extended his hand, and Johnson shook it. Where are you from, Johnson?
Philadelphia.
The name had an extraordinary effect on Marsh. He dropped Johnson's hand and took a step back.
Philadelphia?
You are from Philadelphia?
Yes, sir. Is there something wrong with Philadelphia?
Don't call me sir. And your father is in shipping?
Yes, he is.
Marsh's face turned purple. His body shook with rage.
And I suppose you were a Quaker, too,
hmm?
A Quaker? From Philadelphia?
No. Methodist, actually. Isn't that very close to Quaker?
I don't think so.
But you live in the same city that he does.
That who does?
Marsh fell silent, frowning, staring at the floor. And then he made another of his abrupt turns, shifting his bulk. For a large man, he was surprisingly agile and athletic.
Never mind, he said, smiling once again.
I've no quarrel with any resident of the city of brotherly love, whatever they may say. And yet I imagine you are wondering where my expedition is going this summer, to look for fossils.
The question had never crossed Johnson's mind, but to show proper interest, he replied,
I am a bit curious, yes. I imagine you are. Yes, I imagine you are.
Well,
it is a secret,
Marsh said, leaning close to Johnson's face and hissing the words.
Do you understand me? A secret. And it will remain a secret, known only to me, until we are on the train headed west. Is that completely understood?
Johnson backed away under the vehemence of the words.
Yes, Professor.
Good. If your family desires to know your destination, tell them Colorado.
It isn't true, for we won't go to Colorado this year.
But that doesn't matter because you'll be out of touch anyway. And Colorado is a delightful place not to be.
Understood?
Yes, Professor.
Good.
Now then, we depart June 14th from Grand Central Depot in New York, returning no later than September 1st to the same station. See the museum secretary tomorrow and he will give you a list of provisions you are to provide. In addition, in your case, to your photographic equipment. You will allow supplies sufficient for 100 photographs. Any questions?
No, sir.
No, Professor. Then I will see you at the platform on June 14th, Mr. Johnson. They shook hands briefly. Marsh's hand was damp and cold.
Thank you, Professor.
Johnson turned and headed toward the door.
Where do you think you are going?
To leave.
By yourself?
Well, I can find my way.
No one, Johnson, is permitted unescorted movement through this office.
I am not a fool. I know there are spies eager to look at the latest drafts of my papers, or the latest bones to emerge from the rock. My assistant, Mr. Gall, will see you out. At the mention of his name, a thin, pinched man in a lab coat put down his chisel and walked with Johnson to the door.
Is he always like this?
Johnson whispered.
Lovely weather, Gall said, and smiled. Good day to you, sir.
And William Johnson was back out on the street. Learning photography. Johnson wanted nothing more than to escape the terms of his wager and this impending expedition. Marsh was obviously a lunatic of the first order, and conceivably dangerous as well. He fixed on having another meal with Marlin, and somehow extricating himself from the bet. Yet that evening, to his horror, he learned that the wager had become notorious. It was now known broadly throughout the college, and all during dinner people came to his table to talk about it, to make some small comment or joke. Backing out now was inconceivable. He realized then he was doomed. The following day he went to the shop of Mr. Carlton Lewis, a local photographer who offered 20 lessons in his craft for the outrageous sum of $50. Mr. Lewis was amused with this new pupil. Photography was not a rich man's pursuit, but rather a shifty business for people who lacked the capital to embark on a more prestigious livelihood. Even Matthew Brady, the most famous photographer of his day, the chronicler of the Civil War, the man who photographed statesmen and presidents, had never been treated as anything but a servant by the eminent subjects who sat for him. But Johnson was adamant, and over a period of weeks he learned the skills behind this method of recording, introduced from France 40 years earlier by the telegrapher Samuel Morse. The process then in vogue was the wet plate photographic technique. In a darkened room or tent, fresh chemicals were mixed on the spot, and sheets of glass coated with a sticky, light-sensitive emulsion. The newly made wet plates were then rushed to the camera and exposed to the scene while still wet. Considerable skill was required to prepare an evenly coated plate, and then to expose it before the plate dried. Later development was easy by comparison. Johnson learned with difficulty. He could not carry out the steps fast enough. With the easy rhythms of his teacher, his early emulsions were too thick or too thin, too wet or too dry. His plates had bubbles and dripped densities that made his pictures amateurish. He hated the confined tent, the darkness, and the smelly chemicals that irritated his eyes, stained his fingers, and burned his clothes. Most of all, he hated the fact that he couldn't master the craft easily. And he hated Mr. Lewis, who tended to philosophize.
"You expect everything to be easy because you were rich," Lewis would chuckle, watching him fumble and swear. "But the plate doesn't care how rich you are. The chemicals don't care how rich you are. The lens doesn't care how rich you are. You must first learn patience, if you wish to learn anything at all."
"Damn you," Johnson would say, irritated. The man was nothing but an uneducated shopkeeper putting on airs.
"I am not the problem," Lewis would reply, taking no offense.
"You are the problem. Now come, try again."
Johnson ground his teeth and swore under his breath. But as the weeks passed, he did improve. By late April, his plates were uniform in density, and he was working swiftly enough to make good exposures. His plates were crisp and sharp, and he was pleased as he showed them to his teacher.
"What are you pleased about?" Mr. Lewis asked. "These pictures are wretched."
"Wretched?
They are perfect."
"They're technically perfect," Lewis said, shrugging.
"It means merely that you know enough to begin to learn about photography. I believe that is why you came to me in the first place." Lewis taught him now the details of exposure, the vagaries of f-stop, focal length, depth of field. Johnson despaired, for there was so much more to learn. Shoot portraits wide open with short exposures, because the wide-open lens has a soft quality that flatters the subject. And again, shoot landscapes stopped down with long exposures, because people wish to see a landscape sharp both close and at a distance. He learned to vary contrast by changing exposure and subsequent development time. He learned to position his subjects in the light, to change the composition of his emulsions on bright and dull days. Johnson worked hard and kept detailed notes in his journal, but also complaints. "I despise this little man," observes one characteristic entry, "and yet I desperately want to hear him say what he will not, that I have learned this skill." Yet even in his complaint, one notices a change from the haughty young man who a few months earlier could not be bothered to learn to sail. He wanted to excel at his task. In early May, Lewis held the plate up to the light, then inspected it with a magnifying glass. He finally turned to Johnson. "This work is almost acceptable," he allowed. "You have done well." Johnson was elated. In his journal he wrote, "Almost acceptable. Almost acceptable. Nothing said to me was ever so sweet to my ears." Other aspects of Johnson's demeanor were changing as well. Despite himself, he was beginning to look forward to the trip. "I still regard 3 months in the West in much the same way I would 3 months forced attendance at the German opera. But I have to admit the pleasurable, growing excitement as the fateful departure approaches. I have acquired everything on the list of the museum secretary, including a Bowie knife, a Smith & Wesson 6-shot revolver, a 50-caliber rifle, sturdy cavalry boots, and a geologist's hammer. With each purchase, my excitement grows. I have mastered my photographic techniques passably well. I have acquired the 80 pounds of chemicals and equipment, and the 100 glass plates. I am, in short, ready to go. Only one major obstacle now stands between me and departure. My family. I must return to Philadelphia and tell them." Philadelphia. Philadelphia was the busiest city in America that May, nearly bursting with the vast crowds that flocked to attend the Centennial Exposition of 1876. The excitement that surrounded this celebration of the nation's 100th anniversary was nearly palpable. Wandering the soaring exhibition halls, Johnson saw the wonders that astonished all the world. The great Corliss steam engine, the exhibits of plant and agriculture from the states and territories of America, and the new inventions that were all the rage. The prospect of harnessing the power of electricity was the newest subject. There was even talk of making electrical light to illuminate city streets at night. Everyone said Edison would have a solution within a year. Meanwhile, there were other electrical wonders to puzzle over, particularly the curious device of the telephone. Everyone who attended the exposition saw this oddity, although few considered it of any value. Johnson was among the majority when he noted in his journal, "We already have the telegraph, providing communications for all who desire it. The added virtues of voice communication at a distance are unclear. Perhaps in the future some people will wish to hear the voice of another far away. But there cannot be many. For myself, I think Mr. Bell's telephone is a doomed curiosity with no real purpose." Despite the splendid buildings and enormous crowds, all was not entirely well in the nation. This was an election year, with much talk of politics. President Ulysses S. Grant had opened the Centennial Exposition, but the little general was no longer popular. Scandal and corruption characterized his administration, and the excesses of financial speculators had finally plunged the nation into one of the most severe depressions in its history. Thousands of investors had been ruined on Wall Street. Western farmers were destroyed by the sharp decline in prices, as well as by harsh winters and plagues of grasshoppers. The resurgent Indian wars in the Montana, Dakota, and Wyoming territories provided an unsavory aspect, at least to the Eastern press. And both Democratic and Republican parties promised in this year's campaign to focus on reform. But to a young man, particularly a rich one, all this news, both good and bad, merely formed an exciting backdrop on the eve of his great adventure. I relished the wonders of this exposition, Johnson wrote, but in truth, I found it wearingly civilized. My eyes looked to the future, and to the great plains that would soon be my destination, if my family agreed to let me go. The Johnsons resided in one of the ornate mansions that fronted Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square. It was the only home William had ever known. Lavish furnishings, mannered elegance, and servants behind every door. He decided to tell his family one morning at breakfast. In retrospect, he found their reactions absolutely predictable. "Oh, darling, why ever would you want to go out there?" asked his mother, buttering her toast. "I think it's a capital idea," said his father. "Excellent." "But do you think it's wise, William?" asked his mother. "There's all that trouble with the Indians, you know." "It's good that he's going. Maybe they'll scalp him," announced his younger brother, Edward, who was 14. He said things like that all the time, and no one paid any attention. "I don't understand the appeal," his mother said again, an edge of worry in her voice. "Why do you want to go? It doesn't make any sense. Why not go to Europe instead? Someplace culturally stimulating and safe?"
"I'm sure he'll be safe," his father said. "Only today the Inquirer reports on the Sioux uprising in the Dakotas. They've sent Custer himself to put it down. He'll make short work of them."
"I hate to think of you eaten," said his mother. "Scalped, mother," Edward corrected her. "They cut off all the hair right around the head, after they club you to death, of course. Except sometimes you're not completely dead, and you could feel the knife cutting off the skin and hair right down to the eyebrows."
"Not at breakfast, Edward."
"You're disgusting, Edward," said his sister Eliza, who was 10. "You make me puke."
"Eliza!"
"Well, he does, mother. He is a revolting creature."
"Where exactly will you go with Professor Marsh, son?" his father asked.
"To Colorado."
"Isn't that near the Dakotas?" asked his mother.
"Not very."
"Oh, mother, don't you know anything?" said Edward.
"Are there Indians in Colorado?"
"There are Indians everywhere, mother." "I wasn't asking you, Edward."
"I believe no hostile Indians reside in Colorado," his father said. "They say it's a lovely place, very dry."
"They say it's a desert," said his mother, "and dreadfully inhospitable. What sort of hotel will you stay in?"
"We'll be camping mostly." "Good," his father said. "Plenty of fresh air and exertion. Invigorating."
"You sleep on the ground with all the snakes and animals and insects?"
"It sounds horrific," his mother said.
"Summer in the out of doors. Good for a young man," his father said. "After all, many sickly boys go for the camp cure nowadays."
"I suppose," said his mother.
"But William isn't sickly."
"Why do you want to go, William?"
"I think it's time I made something of myself," William told her, surprised by his own honesty.
"Well said," said his father, pounding the table.
In the end, his mother gave her consent, although she continued to look genuinely worried. He thought she was being maternal and foolish. The fears she expressed only made him feel all the more puffed up, brave, and determined to go. He might have felt differently, had he known that by late summer, she would be informed that her firstborn son was dead.
Ready to dig for Yale. The train left at 8 o'clock in the evening from the cavernous interior of the Grand Central Depot in New York. Finding his way through the station, Johnson passed several attractive young women, accompanied by their families, but could not quite bring himself to meet their curious eyes. Meanwhile, he told himself, he needed to find his party. Altogether, 12 Yale students would accompany Professor Marsh and his staff of 2, Mr. Gall, and Mr. Bellows. Marsh was there early, walking down the line of cars, greeting everyone the same way. "Hello, young fellow. Ready to dig for Yale?" Ordinarily taciturn and suspicious, Marsh was here outgoing and friendly. Marsh had handpicked his students from socially prominent and wealthy families, and these families had come to see their boys off. Marsh was well aware that he was serving as a tour guide to the scions of the rich, who might later be properly grateful for his part in turning their young boys into men. He understood further that since many prominent ministers and theologians explicitly denounced ungodly paleontological research, all research money in his field came from private patrons, among them his financier uncle, George Peabody. Here in New York, the new American Museum of Natural History in Central Park had just been chartered by other self-made men, such as Andrew Carnegie, J. Pierpont Morgan, and Marshall Field. For as eagerly as religious men sought to discredit the doctrine of evolution, so wealthy men sought to promote it. In the principle of the survival of the fittest, they saw a new scientific justification for their own rise to prominence and their own often unscrupulous way of life. After all, no less an authority than the great Charles Lyell, friend and forerunner of Charles Darwin, had insisted again and again, in the universal struggle for existence, the right of the strongest eventually prevails. Here Marsh found himself surrounded by the children of the strongest. Marsh privately maintained to Bellows that the New York send-off is the most productive part of the field trip, and his thinking was firmly in mind when he greeted Johnson with his usual, "Hello, young man, ready to dig for Yale." Johnson was surrounded by a cluster of porters who loaded his bulky photographic equipment aboard. Marsh looked about, then frowned. "Where is your family?" "In Philadelphia, sir, Professor." "Your father did not come to see you off." Marsh recalled that Johnson's father was in shipping. Marsh did not know much about shipping, but it was undoubtedly lucrative and full of sharp practices. Fortunes were made daily in shipping. "My father saw me off in Philadelphia."
"Really?"
"Most families wish to meet me personally, to get a sense of the expedition." "Yes, I am sure, but you see, they felt to come here would strain my mother, who does not completely approve."
"Your mother does not approve?"
Marsh could not conceal the distress in his voice. "Does not approve of what?"
"Surely not of me."
"Oh no, it's the Indians, Professor. She disapproves of my going west because she is afraid of the Indians." Marsh huffed. "She obviously knows nothing of my background. I am widely respected as the intimate friend of the red man. We'll have no trouble with Indians, I promise you." But the situation was altogether unsatisfactory for Marsh, who later muttered to Bellows that Johnson looks older than the others, and hinted darkly that perhaps he is not a student at all. "And his father is in shipping. I think nothing more need be said." The whistle blew. There were final kisses and waves for the students, and the train pulled out of the station. Marsh had arranged for them to travel in a private car, provided by none other than Commodore Vanderbilt himself, now a whitened 82-year-old tucked into his sickbed. It was the first of many agreeable comforts that Marsh had arranged for the trip through his extensive connections with the Army, the government, and captains of industry such as Vanderbilt. In his prime, the crusty Commodore, a hulking figure in a fur coat worn winter and summer, had been admired by all New York. With ruthless and aggressive instincts, as well as a sharply profane tongue, this uneducated Staten Island ferry boy, the son of Dutch peasants, had come to control shipping lines from New York to San Francisco. Later he took an interest in railroads, extending his mighty New York Central from the heart of New York all the way to burgeoning Chicago. He was always good copy, even in defeat. When the secretive Jay Gould bested him for control of the Erie Railway, he announced, "This Erie War has taught me that it never pays to kick a skunk." And on another occasion, his complaint to his lawyers, "What do I care for the law? Ain't I got the power?" had made him a legend. In later years, Vanderbilt became increasingly eccentric, given to fraternizing with clairvoyants and mesmerists, communing with the dead, often on pressing business matters. And though he patronized outrageous feminists such as Victoria Woodhull, he still chased girls a quarter of his age. Some days before, New York newspaper headlines had proclaimed Vanderbilt dying, which had roused the old man out of bed to bellow at reporters, "I am not dying. Even if I was dying, I should have vigor enough to knock this abuse down your lying throats." At least, this was what the journalists reported, though everyone in America knew the Commodore's language was considerably saltier. Vanderbilt's railway car was the last word in elegance and modernity. There were Tiffany lamps, china and crystal service, as well as the clever new sleeper beds invented by George Pullman. By now, Johnson had met the other students, and noted in his journal they were a bit tedious and spoiled, but all in all an adventure-seeking lot. Yet we all share a common fear of Professor Marsh. It was clear, seeing Marsh stride commandingly about the railway car, now sinking into the plush banquette seats to smoke a cigar, now snapping his fingers for the servant to bring him an iced drink, that he imagined himself as suited to these surroundings. And indeed, the newspapers sometimes referred to him as the Baron of Bones, just as Carnegie was the Baron of Steel and Rockefeller the Baron of Oil. Like these other great figures, Marsh was self-made. The son of a New York farmer, he had early shown an interest in fossils and learning. Despite the ridicule of his family, he had attended Phillips Academy Andover, graduating at the age of 29 with high honors and the nickname Daddy Marsh. From Andover he went to Yale, and from Yale to England to plead support from his philanthropic uncle George Peabody. His uncle admired learning in all forms, and was pleased to see a member of his family taking up an academic life. He gave Othniel Marsh the funds to start the Peabody Museum at Yale. The only catch was that Peabody later gave a similar sum to Harvard to start another Peabody Museum there. This was because Marsh espoused Darwinism, and George Peabody disapproved of such irreligious sentiments. Harvard was the home of Louis Agassiz, an eminent zoology professor who opposed Darwin's ideas, and was thus a stronghold of the anti-evolutionists. Harvard would provide a useful corrective to the excesses of his nephew, Peabody felt. All this Johnson learned in whispered conversation in the rocking Pullman bunks that night, before the excited students dropped off to sleep. By morning they were in Rochester, by midday in Buffalo, waiting expectantly for a look at Niagara Falls. Unfortunately, their one glimpse, from a bridge some distance downstream, was anticlimactic. But their disappointment quickly vanished when they were informed that Professor Marsh expected to see them all in his private stateroom at once. Marsh peered up and down the hallway, closed the door, and locked it from the inside. Though the afternoon was warm, he closed all the windows and locked them too. Only then did he turn to the 12 waiting students. "You have undoubtedly wondered where we are going," he said. "But it is too early to inform you yet. I will tell you after Chicago. In the meantime, I caution you to avoid contact with strangers and to say nothing of our plans. He has spies everywhere." Tentatively, one student said, "Who does?" "Cope, of course," Marsh snapped. Hearing this unfamiliar name, the students looked blankly at each other, but Marsh did not notice. He was off on a tirade. "Gentlemen, I cannot warn you against him too strongly. Professor Edward Drinker Cope may pretend to be a scientist,
but in fact he is little better than a common thief and keyhole peeper. I have never known him to obtain by fair labor what he could steal instead. The man is a despicable liar and sneak. Be on your guard.
Marsh was puffing, as if exerted. He glared around the room. Any questions?
There were none.
All right, Marsh said. I merely want the record straight. You will hear more after Chicago. Meantime, keep to yourselves.
Bewildered, the students filed out of the compartment.
One young man named Winslow knew who Cope was. He is another professor of paleontology, I believe at Haverford College in Pennsylvania. He and Marsh were once friends, but are now the most steadfast enemies. As I heard it, Cope tried to steal credit for the professor's first fossil discoveries, and there has been bad feeling between them ever since. And Cope apparently pursued a woman Marsh wanted to marry, and discredited her, or at least sullied her reputation. Cope's father was a wealthy Quaker merchant, left him millions, I was told. So Cope does as he pleases. It seems he is a bit of a rogue and charlatan. There's no end of sly tricks he will pull to steal from Marsh what is rightfully his. That's why Marsh is so suspicious. He is ever on the watch for Cope and his agents.
I knew nothing of this, Johnson said.
Well, you know now, Winslow responded. He stared out the window at rolling green cornfields. The train had left New York State, passed through Pennsylvania, and was in Ohio. Speaking for myself, he said, I don't know why you were on this expedition. I'd never go, except my family made me. My father insists that a summer in the West will put hair on my chest. He shook his head in wonder.
God, all I can think of is 3 months of bad food and bad water and bad insects. And no girls. No fun. God.
Still curious about Cope, Johnson asked Marsh's assistant Bellows, a pinch-faced zoology instructor. Bellows immediately became suspicious.
Why do you ask?
I am simply curious. But why do you particularly ask? None of the other students have asked.
Perhaps they are not interested.
Perhaps they have no reason to be interested.
That amounts to the same thing, Johnson said.
Does it?
Bellows asked, with a meaningful look.
I ask you, does it really?
Well, I think so, Johnson said, although I'm not sure. The conversation has become so convoluted.
Don't patronize me, young man, Bellows said. You may think I am a fool. You may think we are all fools. But I assure you, we are not.
And he walked off, leaving Johnson more curious than ever.
Marsh's diary entry. Bellows reports student W.J. has asked about Cope. The audacity. The nerve! He must think we are fools. I'm very angry. Angry. Angry! Our suspicions about W.J. obviously confirmed. Philadelphia background. The shipping background, etc. Only too clear. We'll speak with W.J. tomorrow and set the stage for later developments. I will see that this young man causes us no trouble.
The farmlands of Indiana raced past the window, mile after mile, hour after hour, lulling Johnson to a sense of monotony. With his chin propped on his hand, he was drifting off to sleep when Marsh said, "What exactly do you know about Cope?" Johnson sat up abruptly.
"Nothing, Professor." "Well, I'll tell you some things that perhaps you don't know. He killed his own father to get his inheritance. Did you know that?"
"No, Professor. Not 6 months ago, he killed him. And he cheats on his wife, an invalided woman who has never harmed him in the least way. Worships him, in fact. That's how deluded the poor creature is."
"He sounds a complete criminal."
Marsh shot him a look.
You don't believe me?
I believe you, Professor. Also, personal hygiene is not his strong point. The man is odoriferous and unsanitary. But I've no wish to be personal.
No, Professor.
The fact is he is unscrupulous and untrustworthy in the extreme. There was a land grab and mineral rights scandal. That's why he was kicked out of the Geological Survey.
He was kicked out of the Geological Survey?
Years ago.
You don't believe me?
I believe you, Professor.
Well, you don't look like you believe me.
I believe you,
Johnson insisted.
I believe you.
There was a silence. The train clattered on. Marsh cleared his throat.
Do you know Professor Cope, by any chance?
No, I don't.
I thought perhaps you did.
No, Professor.
If you did know him, you would feel better if you told me all about it now, Marsh said, instead of waiting.
If I did, Professor, Johnson said, I would. But I do not know the man.
Yes, Marsh said, studying Johnson's face. Later that day, Johnson met a painfully thin young man making notes in a small leather-bound book. He was from Scotland, and said his name was Lewis Stevenson.
How far are you going? Johnson asked.
All the way to the end.
California,
Stevenson said, lighting another cigarette. He smoked continually. His long, delicate fingers were stained dark brown. He coughed a great deal, and in general did not look like the sort of robust person who seeks a journey west, and Johnson asked him why he was doing so.
I am in love, Stevenson said simply. She is in California.
And then he made more notes, and seemed to forget Johnson for a time. Johnson went off in search of more congenial company, and came across Marsh.
That young man there, Marsh said, nodding across the carriage.
What about him?
You were talking to him.
His name is Stevenson.
I don't trust a man who makes notes, Marsh said.
What did you talk about?
He's from Scotland, and he is going to California to find a woman he is in love with.
How romantic.
And did he ask you where you were going?
No, he wasn't the least interested.
Marsh squinted at him.
So he says.
I have made inquiries about that Stevenson fellow, Marsh announced to the group later. He's from Scotland, on his way to California to find a woman. His health is poor. Apparently he fancies himself a writer. That's why he makes all those notes.
Johnson said nothing.
Just thought you would be interested to know, Marsh said.
Personally, I think he smokes too much.
Marsh looked out the window.
Ah, the lake, he said. We will soon be in Chicago.
Chicago. Chicago was the fastest growing city in the world, both in population and in commercial importance. From a prairie village of 4,000 in 1840, it had exploded into a metropolis of 500,000 and was now doubling its size every 5 years. Known as Slab Town and the Mud Hole of the Prairie, the city now extended across 35 square miles along Lake Michigan and boasted paved streets and sidewalks, broad thoroughfares with streetcars, elegant mansions, fine shops, hotels, art galleries, and theaters. And this despite the fact that most of the city had been razed in a terrible fire just 5 years before. Chicago's success owed nothing to climate and locale. The shores of Lake Michigan were swampy. Most of the early buildings had sunk into the mud until they were jacked up by the brilliant young Chicago engineer George Pullman. Water was so polluted that visitors often found small fish in their drinking water. There were even minnows in dairy milk. And the weather was abhorrent, hot in summer, brutally cold in winter, and windy in all seasons. Chicago owed its success to its geographical position in the heartland of the country, to its importance as a rail and shipping center, and most particularly
to its preeminence in the handling of prodigious tonnages of beef and pork. I like to turn bristles, blood, and the inside and outside of pigs and bullocks into revenue, said Philip Armour, one of the founders of the gigantic Chicago stockyards. Along with fellow meatpacking magnate Gustavus Swift, Armour ruled an industry that dispatched 1 million head of cattle and 4 million pigs each year, and which employed 1/6 of the population of the city. With their centralized distribution, mechanized slaughter, and refrigerated railroad cars, the barons of Chicago were creating a whole new industry. Food processing. The Chicago stockyards were the largest in the world, and many visitors went to see them. One of the Yale students was the nephew of Swift, and they went off to tour the yards, which Johnson regarded as a dubious tourist attraction. But Marsh was not stopping in Chicago for tourism. He was there on business. From the magnificent Lakeshore Railroad Depot, he took his charges to the nearby Grand Pacific Hotel. Here the students were awed by one of the largest and most elegant hotels in the world. As everywhere, Marsh had arranged special accommodations for his party, and there were newspaper men waiting to interview him. Othniel Marsh was always good copy. The year before, in 1875, he had uncovered a scandal in the Indian Bureau, whereby Bureau officers were not dispensing food and funds to the reservations, but were instead keeping the proceeds for themselves, while Indians literally starved. Marsh had been informed of this by Red Cloud himself, the legendary Sioux chief, and had revealed the evidence in Washington, severely embarrassing the Grant presidency in the eyes of the liberal Eastern establishment. Marsh was a good friend of Red Cloud, and thus reporters wanted to talk to him about the Sioux wars now raging. "It is a terrible conflict," Marsh said, "but there are no easy answers to the Indian question." Then, too, Chicago reporters never tired of repeating the story of Marsh's earliest public exploit, the affair of the Cardiff Giant. In 1869, the fossilized skeleton of a 10-foot giant was unearthed in Cardiff, New York, and quickly became a national phenomenon. It was generally agreed that the giant was one of a race of men who had been drowned in Noah's flood. Gordon Bennett of the New York Herald and a number of scholars had pronounced it genuine. Marsh, in his capacity as the new paleontology professor from Yale, went to view the fossil and said, within earshot of a reporter, "Very remarkable." "May I quote you?" said the reporter. "Yes," said Marsh. "You may quote me as saying, a very remarkable fake." It was later determined that the so-called giant originated as a block of gypsum, carved secretly in Chicago. But the incident brought national attention to Marsh, and he had been talking to reporters ever since. "And what brings you to Chicago now?" one reporter asked. "I am on my way west to find more bones," Marsh said. "And will you be seeing bones in Chicago?" Marsh laughed. "No," he said. "In Chicago, we will see General Sheridan to arrange our army liaison." Marsh took Johnson with him because he wanted to be photographed with General Sheridan. Little Phil Sheridan was a compact, energetic man of 45. With a fondness for plug tobacco and tart expression. He had assembled the army staff now waging the Indian War, Generals Crook, Terry, and Custer, all of whom were in the field hunting out the Sioux. Sheridan was particularly fond of Armstrong Custer, and had risked the disapproval of President Grant by ordering Custer back into service, along with Generals Crook and Terry in the Indian Wars. "It's no easy campaign," Sheridan said, "and we need a man with Custer's dash. The Indians are being driven from their homes, whether we care to see it that way or not, and they'll fight us like devils. And the fact that the Indian Agency supplies them with good rifles doesn't help either. The main conflict promises to be in Montana and Wyoming."
"Wyoming," Marsh said. "Will there be problems for our group?"
He did not seem the least perturbed, Johnson noticed.
I can't see why, Sheridan said, spitting with remarkable accuracy at a metal basin across the room. So long as you stay out of Wyoming and Montana, you'll be safe enough. Marsh posed for a photograph, standing rigidly beside General